The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they
main
are
engine
hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon. It's not morning, even in California. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. It's great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. And we are going to have a very interesting and a little bit of a different perspective on things on our show today. But first, for those of you who would like to call and talk to our guest, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Do let the phone ring until it can be answered, and we'll bring you up on air as soon as possible. The toll-free line is opened at this time. For those of you who would like to Skype in, remember it's computer to computer. Use a headset, please, so we can avoid some feedback. And our Skype ID is one word, The Space Show. For those of you still wanting to do email, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And do remember that we're trademarked and copyrighted. You can download these MP3s and share them, put them on a memory stick, a DVD, however you want to share them and help get the word out as to why space is fun, interesting, educational, informative, valuable, all of the things. Get it out there to people in a broader community than just the space community. You're certainly welcome to do that. Please don't edit any of the programs. Don't put them up on any private YouTube channels or anything like that. Nothing commercial with the shows. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own use. That said, if you do have any ideas or special requests with our programs, please do let me hear from you at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And remember, you're certainly free to quote from any of our programs. Please just use an academic citation. If you don't know a multimedia academic citation format, please email me and I'll send you the formats for most of the style guides, both in literature as well as academia. So we appreciate your paying attention to these very few and limited rules. Please do visit our website, thespaceshow.com. Our comprehensive newsletter goes up Sunday evening. It has all of the guest bio information. It has the programming information for the week. It is the only place you'll find the future events schedule, what's in store over the next several weeks for the Space Show. And then if we have to change our schedule or make any announcements, you're going to find it here first. So do check it out. Also, don't forget that this is the place where we will let you make announcements if you have something really important. And, I mean, I don't push that all the time, but it's there. If you need to get something out to a big group of people, I'm not talking about a conference. I'm talking about something really important. We'll help you do that. You just need to get a hold of me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived on our site. You can listen to all of our shows directly from our website, or you can easily download them. There is a Space Show store. You'll see it up near the top of our page called Space Show Gear. We now have our social media buttons on our website, as well as on the One Giant Leap website. And therefore, you can get to our Facebook pages, LinkedIn, all of those good things quite easily. And then, of course, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we are a nonprofit, 501c3, with the One Giant Leap Foundation. And we can't do this show without your financial support. So we thank all of you who do support us and who will be supporting us. And remember, we're coming up on the end of the year. For those of you who are inspired and motivated by the need for tax deductions, please do consider the Space Show. We are going to send out our annual campaign letter as we approach Thanksgiving. But remember, if you pay U.S. taxes, you do get a federal tax deduction. And if you pay California taxes, you get a California deduction, as we're a public benefit corporation in California. I'm not sure what happens with all the other states. Please check with your advisors on that. And then also remember that the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, please visit their website, which is secureworldfoundation.org. And that brings me to our program today. And I'm happy to introduce all of you, David, and I hope I'm getting your last name right. It's Portry.
Very good.
Ah, great. And he is the author of a blog, which is how I found him, Beyond Apollo. So it's http://beyondapollo.blogspot.com. So to give you an idea, a little bit of his background, he says he was born a month before John Glenn became the first American in orbit. So those of you who know a little space history know when he was born. He then got interested in geology. I wonder why geology. We'll ask him about this. Space exploration and sci-fi. So I can connect the dots with space exploration and sci-fi. Geology, we'll find out about that in a few minutes, by the time Apollo 8 orbited the moon. Then he added writing, and he is a writer, astronomy and history to his interest by the time the Viking lander looked for life on Mars. He has a master's degree in history, which came to him in 1987, the same year he actually sold his first work, which is pretty cool. He's worked with a number of planetariums. He's done quite a few writings for things that all of you would know about, like Earth and Sky, Stardate, Earth Notes, the Astronaut Hall of Fame. And now most of his writings are published on his Beyond Apollo blog. Here's an interesting thing that I don't get to tell people about very often. He has taught astronomy and conducted star parties at middle and elementary schools on the Navajo and Hopi reservations as part of the Navajo-Hopi Astronomy Outreach Project at the Lowell Observatory, which is in Flagstaff. He also has an article, Flagstaff's Battle for Dark Skies. I did a show on that a number of years ago, which won second prize in the Boeing Griffith Observatory Science Writing Contest back in 2002. Anyway, his full bio is on his blog, and it's also on the Space Show website. And David, welcome to the Space Show. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. No, thank you. I'm kind of feeling a little humble right now after you hearing you read my bio. I guess it makes me feel just a little bit embarrassed.
Well, did I lie about any? What part is not true then?
No, I think it's all true. It's just I'm not used to hearing anybody read it.
So tell me, this is not how I told you we'd start the show, but you became interested in space exploration and sci-fi because of Apollo 8. And I can connect those dots, but where does geology fit into the situation?
Well, I didn't get interested in it because of Apollo 8 so much, although that's the first mission that I remember. I got interested in it mostly because of the film 2001, A Space Odyssey. I had already begun to get interested in science, and as you mentioned, geology was kind of in the lead, understanding the way the Earth was formed and the way the landscape around me was formed was really interesting to me. When I heard about this thing called a science fiction movie, I thought, whoa, science, let's go see that. And I begged my parents, and they took me, and I was bit by both the science fiction and the space bug in one go.
And was it an infectious bite? You never got cured?
Yeah, I'm stuck with it, I'm afraid.
So let's start out, and your blog, beyondapollo.blogspot.com. Tell us a little about that. When did you start it? What is its purpose? What do you typically put up on it? That type of thing.
Yeah, sure. Beyond Apollo is the latest manifestation of something I started back in 1996, which was a website called Romance to Reality. And the idea of that website was to try to promote all the different options that people have created over the years for exploring the moon and Mars. More recently, with the starting of this blog, I've taken a different approach. I've tried to cover more history and context give more background to a lot of different space studies, including space stations and vibration points and all sorts of other things, and a lot more robotic missions, too. So a broader spectrum with this new blog. The idea for that is that I wanted to draw more people in, be of interest to more people, and potentially be more relevant to more people.
And can you tell if your blog is reaching more and more people? Do you get a lot of feedback and comments and hate mail and stuff like that?
I don't know. I don't get too much hate mail. Once in a while, somebody will post something inappropriate to my Facebook page, and then they'll respond when I delete it. They'll respond in an unfavorable way, but that doesn't happen very often. I've been a regular audience. There's a number of people. I actually hope I hear from some today, whom I know entirely through their feedback to the blog, and that's kind of nice. And then there are, I probably get around 250 to 300 hits a day. Isn't a huge number, but it's pretty steady.
Yeah, that is pretty steady. What do you, since you like to write and you know history, what are your favorite space subjects that you like to talk about vis-a-vis history and write about?
Wow, that's a hard question. It kind of varies from one day to the next. I'm always looking for new documents to read, and the ones that seem to be of interest to people that just sort of click are the ones that I write about on the blog. And they can cover, you know, any number of subjects. Lately, I've been doing a lot on the Apollo Applications Program, the program that was supposed to come after Apollo, but sort of devolved into Skylab and then ended there. And I've also been looking into studies of rescue methods, I guess you'd say, and also potential failure modes or accidents that people investigated during the 60s, primarily having to do with the Apollo program.
What did you find out in looking at failure modes? Did you ever compare any of that to what happened in shuttle history?
Not so much in shuttle so far, although I did recently write a piece about what would happen to the shuttle, the Galileo spacecraft, and the IUS, at that time, interim upper stage, now known as the inertial upper stage. What would have happened to those if something had gone wrong with the orbiter immediately after separating from the external tank? If control had been lost and it had tumbled or something like that. The short answer was the orbiter would continue to climb, tumbling for a while, and then when it would fall back into the atmosphere and break apart, under most circumstances, the IUS and Galileo would break apart too, and under a fair number of, in a fair number of cases, the RTGs would have melted and the individual fuel packages inside the RTGs would have been released. Now, as for whether that would have caused, you know, radioactive release, that wasn't really addressed in the study. But that's probably the main shuttle accident mode paper I've looked at. The ones that I've found more interesting have been things like what would have happened if Neil Armstrong had to abort the landing. What if the fuel gauges on Eagle, which were, you know, none too accurate, had been even less accurate, and he felt the need to abort, what potential problems would have occurred. And that, to me, is real interesting. And also the idea that you could get stranded in lunar orbit, perhaps. CSM, maybe the SPS, the service propulsion system, the main rocket engine on the command and service module might not function. And if that were the case, how long would the crew last? Could they be rescued? That sort of thing.
Tell me, what would have happened if he had to abort?
Well, according to a fellow by the name of, I'm going to probably mispronounce his name, but Tejera, I believe. He was a fellow at the Manned Spacecraft Center, which is now Johnson Spacecraft Center in Houston. The descent stage would have fallen to the ground, the lunar surface, I should say. The ascent stage of the lunar module would have, of course, ignited its engine, would have fallen a little bit because it would have, you know, needed to get up enough speed to start moving upward again. Meanwhile, the descent stage would hit the ground, and depending on how much propellant was inside and whether or not the tanks broke, the hydrazine or the hypergolic propellants inside would have mixed and caused an explosion. And there was a better than even chance that the shockwave from the explosion would have crushed the ascent stage, or that a piece of the descent stage could have struck the ascent stage. So there was a pretty good chance that an abort close to the surface would have failed. It would have led to the same the same end as if it had just fallen out of the sky after running out of fuel.
But they would have had to be close to the surface of the moon for that to happen.
That's right, yeah, pretty close, within about 300 or 400 feet.
Well, I guess we'll never know, right?
Yeah, it's a good thing we didn't have to test that.
Here's your first question of the day. I'm curious if, for fun, you've looked at any of the information on the Phobos Grunt mission and tried to play around with how that might have been rescued had shuttle or some other spaceflight vehicles been available.
Well, you know, first off, it's a terrible thing that this mission has failed. It was a very exciting mission.
By the way, that was Bob in Denver who asked that question.
Well, hi, Bob. It's a terrible thing that this mission has failed. I'm really interested in sample return missions, and I guess that's partly because of my long-time interest in geology. Getting rocks back from far-off places is exciting. So getting some samples back from the moon Phobos would have been really nice. However, of course, we know the Russian record on Mars has never been terribly great, and so this is sort of in keeping with the tradition, I suppose you could say. As for salvaging the mission once it is in Earth orbit, it's hard to imagine how that could be done. The spacecraft, as I understand it, doesn't have any provision for being captured, no fixtures for putting it into a payload bay or anything like that. I suppose, in some perfect world where, you know, you can launch shuttles or something on demand, maybe you could do something to push it to a higher orbit, perhaps, or something like that. But I think the likelihood of actually being able to do anything to salvage it, even if we did have shuttles like that, would be pretty small. One thing that's kind of unfortunate about space is that it's not really routine yet. It takes a lot of advanced planning and preparation to do things. And so when you get a surprise event like this, it's a little bit hard to do anything about it.
There was a UK media article, I forget which paper it was that I read it online, and I always read the comments to these articles, and about half the comments were, see, we should have had the shuttle flying, it could have gone up and rescued the mission and saved it. And I'm thinking, really, how do you even know a shuttle could have gotten to the orbit of Phobos Grunt? I mean, I don't even know what its orbit was, although I guess you could find out what that was.
But. Well, it's a low orbit. It's high, relatively well, it's actually not that high in inclination, but it's, it's not like polar or anything like that.
No, but
it's, it would be a hard mission, it probably wouldn't be a hard orbit to get into with a shuttle, but, once you got up there, what would you do? There's no fixtures on it for linking the robot arm, the RMS on the shuttle to it. There's no, if you wanted to bring it back down to Earth, I don't even know if it would fit. But assuming it did, there's no fixtures for securing it in the payload bay. In the shuttle days, when we went after things in orbit to bring them back or to repair them, typically they were designed for repair or recovery. It was very rare for us to do impromptu servicing. And when we did, there was a lot of preparation on the ground anyway.
Couldn't you just use big bungee cords like you do with a moving van?
Wouldn't that be nice?
I read the Grunt mission was about $180 million US dollars, something like that. So at the cost of nearly $1 billion to launch the shuttle, that doesn't seem to have economics in balance.
No, it doesn't seem to make sense. I guess the only concern would be, or the only justification would be, is if we were, really concerned about some kind of accident affecting lives and property on the ground. And there is some potential, of course, always for that sort of thing to happen. Not very likely, given that 70% of the Earth is covered by water, and there's a lot of places where there aren't very many people. But, if we knew for sure it was going to land on New York City or something, maybe, then we'd have a justification. But otherwise, I don't really think so.
Helen in Tacoma sent in this email, and she said, I'm curious if you spend any time on your blog writing about the space policy issues and dysfunction, as David and others on his show like to report. Does your blog cover any of the current activity? I'm on it right now, and it's all about, it seems, past history.
Well, yeah, it is a history blog, definitely. I think the most recent thing on there is an interesting unmanned proposal from maybe the year 2010, if I recall. But there's very little after about 1995. That's probably about as close as I get without, feeling like I'm getting too contemporary. Generally, I like to do the 60s and 70s the most because that's where a lot of the ideas that have since been considered first played out. I like to look for when we first thought about doing certain things and then try to trace that to some culmination. I don't really get into the current space policy debate. Of course, there's parallels occasionally. I kind of leave that to the reader to sort out for themselves. Occasionally, I'll make comments about things that are a little more recent or make an observation about a general principle that may apply today. But, no, it's primarily historical, as Helen has noted.
Do you get into so you don't address the modern day policy debates and space tourism and commercial or any of those types of issues then?
I get into that occasionally on my Facebook page, or if somebody will bring it up in the comments when they comment on something, I'll try to address that. But typically, the blog posts, the blog articles themselves are definitely historical. And I think that's important because, one of my core principles is that if you don't understand history, you don't really understand where you're at. You need to be able to understand the background of events to understand decisions being made today. And that's even the deep background going all the way back to Apollo. People sometimes, just an example, people sometimes think that Apollo was a very different time, that we had blank checks and what have you, but that was never true. And toward the end of, following the Apollo 1 fire, there were people in Congress who wanted to punish NASA and cut back on its resources. It wasn't like we had a 100% consolidated view about whether going to the moon was a good idea or that it should continue indefinitely. And that has some relevance to the current debate. There are a large number of people out there who don't think it's worth doing. And that's always been the case.
Well, they especially say it isn't worth doing when they look at what's been happening with space. So, I guess that's another part of the debate. Have we really been doing things in space wisely and effectively and efficiently?
I think when you have to take into account a lot of different viewpoints, and that includes both political and cultural, social kind of viewpoints, that you end up with something that isn't optimal in an engineering sense. I think there's no way to avoid that. That the shuttle is a case in point. But so was Apollo. The lunar orbit rendezvous scenario for getting to the moon had its disadvantages. And one of them was that you couldn't deliver a lot of payload to the surface of the moon, which led to made it harder to do some of the missions that scientists would have liked to have seen, like two-week stays with lunar flying vehicles and all that kind of stuff. If we'd done a direct flight type of mode, it would have certainly been more flexible. However, we probably wouldn't have met the political goal of by the end of the decade.
Probably. So I have a historical question for you.
Okay.
Okay. Let me see how to word this. It's not really about space. It's history in general.
Okay.
So a few minutes ago you said, if you don't really understand history, you can't you really can't understand where you are today or where you're going or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So much of history today is taught from an agenda and an ideological point of view. That my first question is, how do you know the history you're learning, especially if you're a student, a middle school or a high school student, or probably even a college student, is authentic or revisionist or slanted for the ideology of the author of the textbook or of the school board or of the teacher?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'm just speaking here in terms of personal opinions, not so much in terms of any in-depth knowledge in this field. Anytime you pick up any source of information that contains history, you have to beware of the author's interpretations, the author's background, the axes they have to grind. I guess the same goes with any teacher, any professor, any textbook, any school board. You're going to have interpretations that maybe fit into the range of possible possibilities, but don't present all the possibilities. I'm making myself clear. I'm not sure. People are going to choose what works best for them when they present history. But somebody as revered as, say, Abraham Lincoln is a fan. I'm a fan of his. People have written books about him being a horrible dictator, or about him being, a murderous invader, and things of that nature. At the same time, you also have people who've written books about him that make him seem like a saint. The truth usually lies somewhere in between, and you're kind of required yourself, if you're interested enough, to explore all the different interpretations and try to sort out what seems like the truth. But that's one of the problems with history. It's always going to contain some bias.
But then if you have a grade school or a middle school or a high school student, they're probably not that interested. They're taking the class,
right?
Because they either have to, or they, the teacher's got a reputation as being a pushover, or their best, or their best friends in it, or something like that, and they don't know better than to go independently see what Manifest Destiny is, for example,
right?
Or this or that about Abraham Lincoln. So they carry with them a perception of history or a rendition of history that is just as likely to be incorrect as it is correct, and then they build on a false base as they continue through their educational process.
Yeah.
And the likelihood of it being corrected by another teacher or another set of facts is not likely, unless they're doing a minor or a major or doing reports or something where they do have to get in and do some independent research. So in a sense, studying history can be really detrimental to your health, I guess, depending on how you studied it.
Yeah, and depending on whether or not you think you're going to get a job in the field, too.
Well, but then it carries with you on how you vote, your role as a citizen, your ability to understand what's going on in the country today. All of this is rooted, exactly as you said, in having a real understanding of our history.
Right.
But if that understanding is flawed or pointed this way or that way because of a teacher or a school board or an author's bent in the textbook, you're a manipulated pawn in the system, and you don't even know it.
Well, I suppose that you could make that case. I know I'm a manipulated pawn in some areas, obviously, because I can't cover everything. I can't understand everything that's out there. And who has time? I guess my blog is concerned, my effort is to try to present something that's substantiated, a historical account that is substantiated, has something behind it. It's not just opinions or repetition of old views. If a person is interested in understanding the background to space, the space program that they're familiar with or wants to know things about it that maybe don't get included in the mainstream kind of histories, it's probably not a bad place to go. I wouldn't ever claim that my interpretation is the only one. You know, I tend to make the case, for example, that the Jet Propulsion Laboratory tends to love rovers too much, for example. And they tend to go for bigger and bigger rovers, and they've always wanted to since the 70s. But, you know, some people would argue that that's an incorrect interpretation. And it's up to the reader to read, if they're interested, to read as much as they can and figure it out for themselves, really.
You know, and we'll take a break in a minute, but just to set the record straight for listeners, if you think I'm skirting on the edge of being particularly political here, I'm really not. I'm not pointing to one party or another or one administration or another. And just to make my case, I watched a middle of the night, for some stupid reason, rerun of the old cowboy Have Gun Will Travel, so half the audience won't know what I'm talking about. But this little 30-minute episode, David, had to do with a little one-room schoolhouse someplace in the West who has an ethical and principled school marm teacher who looks like the old spinster, you know, with her hair up, very stereotyped, you know, the whole thing. And the town is made up of half the people from the North who fought in the Civil War for the North, and the other half are from the South and fought for the Confederacy, and they're all getting along okay. And here comes some town bully with his thugs into town, and they're PO'd because the teacher is actually teaching a factual thing about Quantrill's raiders. And he was a Confederate officer who served okay in the Confederacy, and then the raiders were pretty violent, despicable people disrupting the countryside and killing people and stealing and stuff. And because he was a Southern guy, he insisted that she teach only the good about William Quantrill and his raiders. And if she didn't do that, he was going to burn down the schoolhouse and all the books and everything. And, of course, Paladin comes in to save the day for ethics and integrity. You know, the right always wins on these things. And, I mean, this stuff has been going on, you know, long before anything current, where for one reason or another, education is taught with a bias, either because you're forced to, as in this case, the woman held her ground, and that's why Paladin came in to rescue, or because of your own, persuasions, and you love the South, and you don't want to say anything bad about Quantrill.
Sure.
So, you know, it's been going on and on and on, and I really wish it wasn't that way, but it just seems to me that you're not going to ever turn that around. So there has to be, there ought to be like a thing on Google where you can say, check and verify.
And there are certain things like that out there, like Snopes. They cover certain things.
Well, yeah, like urban myths and stuff like that. But right. Like if you're doing research on Abraham Lincoln for this, you click a little button and it says trust but verify, and you find out the other side of the story or something different to make it really easy for people.
Well, if you made it too easy, sorry for interrupting, but if you made it too easy, the historian wouldn't have a job. I mean, part of the thing that historians do is to explore these different interpretations, come up with new ones. And, is there a correct interpretation? Sure, but you'd probably need a time machine to figure out which one was right.
Not everything is as black and white as what the raiders were doing around the West, because they left a trail of blood and horror wherever they go. So that really was kind of black and white. Anyway, here I want to take a break, but I'll do Anthony from Poole, England. See, they have the problem over there, too. In a perfect world or la-la land without the constraints of politics and economics, I've read in a book, which I unfortunately can't remember the name of, I'm very sorry for, the following. Fact, 1969, Man on the Moon. Fiction, late 1970s, a moon base. Fiction, mid-80s, Footprints on Mars. Fiction, late 1990s, Mars base. Fiction, 2010, a manned mission to Enceladus. Can you please push the boat out and make a prediction on when these sets of events will play out from this date? He uses the dates backward from us. So it's 11, November 12th. I was about to say you're in the wrong month, Anthony, but I forgot the U.K. does everything backwards from
us. Yeah, I think that's a European thing.
Yeah, it's a whole European thing, or maybe we do it backwards from them.
Yeah.
With our current progress of space exploration, well, I would say it's not even on the horizon, Anthony. I don't even know when we'll go beyond Leo. So you're talking about moon bases and other things. I don't know. Maybe the other David has a better timeline magic whiz device than I do.
Yeah, I need my time machine to go forward for that. I have the feeling, and I know a lot of people don't share this. I have the feeling that maybe the old paradigm that we've used for a long time may be in the course of making some pretty dramatic changes. I personally don't have a problem with robots doing most of the work, for example, and maybe that's the direction we're headed, is more and more robotics, less, dreams of humans on other worlds. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily the case, but given the costs, given the kind of the lack of interest, I guess you could say, in humans going places, to me that seems like the area where we'll probably be concentrating more and more. That said, if for some reason there was a good justification, when I say a good one, I mean one that fits into everyday concerns of a large number of people. We've already seen that we can get to the moon in, under 10 years. And we've got a lot of background now. We understand a lot more than we did. We could get to Mars in 10 years if we decided to. I'm not sure that we ever will, but we could. And in the meantime, we're learning a great deal about it. So I don't feel, I don't feel like we've fallen really that far short. There's spacecraft that we've built that are scattered across the solar system from Mercury all the way out to the heliopause. That's pretty impressive. And it's only been 60 years, 50 years since we started. So I think that's pretty good.
So you're basically saying even though the humans haven't done it, we're still getting tons and tons of good quality data.
Well, humans did it.
Going out to Mars, putting a permanent base on the moon, type of...
Yeah, well, I think that's partly influenced by where I work. I work for the Astrogeology Science Center of the U.S. Geological Survey, and I have an archival job there. I keep track of their history. And so I work around a lot of people who are doing current research, and they're real explorers. They're looking at the data. They're mapping places that have never been mapped before. They're witnessing things that no one else has ever seen before. To me, that's very similar to what would happen if an astronaut went. Because after all, we can't all go. We'd be seeing through the eyes of the astronaut. This way, we're seeing through the eyes of machines and the researchers who interpret the data from those machines. It's not that different.
Well, except for the adventure side of it.
Yeah. Well, I think the robots are pretty cool myself. I mean, think about Phobos Grunt trapped in orbit. It's going to fall somewhere. That's pretty adventurous.
Yeah, but, people like to see other people going out there and
I suppose.
Doing this,
maybe it's because I'm getting old and cynical or something, but to me, the bang for the buck for the machines tends to be better these days. It has been for quite a while. Apollo was very exciting, but I think that nowadays robotic missions could do at least what Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin did very easily, probably under a discovery cost cap.
Probably true, but listen to this email from Beth, and then we'll take our break.
Okay.
Beth is in Portland, Oregon, and said, let's see, American history, and I am assigned a class to read The Perils and Exploits of Rover 2A instead of Lewis and Clark's expedition. Somehow I don't think it has the same fun, meaning, excitement, or information, even though the actual content might be as good or as interesting. Also, reading about an Indian attack on a rover might really be something worthwhile.
Yeah, I don't think we're gonna. I'm not sure if she means Indian attacks a couple centuries ago on a rover, or
Indian attacks on Mars. No, but, I think she meant, you know, at the time of Lewis and Clark, if they had done. I think she's being sarcastic.
Oh, I understand.
About you know, a rover's doing Lewis and Clark's work.
I think if she or, and some other people who are detractors of machine exploration. If they were to work in a place like I do, and I'm not saying that that makes me, you know, my opinion the only opinion, but I think if they worked in a place like that and saw people doing real exploration, you know, you've got slightly overweight guys sitting around in front of computers, but they're seeing things and doing things that no one's ever done before. And that's exploration, and that may be the form that exploration takes in the centuries to come. It's hard to say. I don't know for sure, but... You know, what I see right now makes me think that that's probably the case.
And they'll probably get slightly more overweight as time goes on. They're just sitting in front of a computer.
Yeah, the scientists tend not to get out much, so they tend to see. I'm going to probably get fired now.
order in from the local Big Mac, right?
There you go.
Hold it there, David, and everybody else will be back with more of your comments and questions and more from our guests. And hopefully some of you will pick up the phone and use it instead of your emails. 1-866-687-7223. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to part two of the Sunday Space Show program. Our guest today, David Portree, and you can call us, and we actually have a caller on hold right now, 1-866-687-7223, and I will give priority to our caller. Good afternoon, caller. Who are you, please?
This is Marshall.
Okay, Marshall, and congratulations on your Oklahoma State team doing so well.
Well, actually, it's going to be the Stillwater game in a couple more weeks.
Yeah, with Oklahoma, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Oh, yeah, it looks great. Anyway, listening to the show, your comments on robots and Lewis and Clark, absolutely on target. The key thing that Lewis and Clark proved by doing the trip rather than a robot was it proved that people could go out there and live. And the big plus about moving into space is unbelievably huge amount of space for humans to live in and to expand, and not only knowledge, but the number of people and the improvement in the quality of life. And robots won't do that.
I think robots are necessary as precursors. I think you need to understand the places you're going before you start talking about sending people there, even exploring people. You certainly need to do that before you start talking about settlement. If you don't know the hazards, for example, that you're going to face, you run the risk of failing in a big way. Let me put it this way. The folks who settled at Jamestown in Virginia, something like half the population that went there died in the first 10 or 20 years of settlement. If they had been able to send something ahead to find out about the hazards, maybe they would have been better prepared and far fewer people would have been killed. I think you need to take advantage of all the tools you have, basically. Yeah.
Well, that brings up the fun point of how much is enough and how much isn't enough. And, oh, that is such a fuzzy.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't think anybody would dare answer that one.
Well, you know, I had this email, and actually the two of you have tied into it, from Barbara, and Barbara's in Boulder, Colorado. And Barbara was asking the question about robots and all of this, and she said, actually, I think robots enhance and facilitate better use of humans once they go into space. It isn't one or the other, as
exactly.
far as I can see. It's a combination, and it's all in how you use the two together.
I think that's absolutely true. Absolutely. I think Barbara hit it right on the head.
I totally agree also. It's a combination. I don't think, well, nobody's going to live on a base on the moon without having a lunar rover out there doing a lot of the precursor work to make sure, you know, to get things done.
They might even build
their hands. Robots can't fix themselves yet. And they're, you know, you pull the robot in and it takes a human to debug and fix the things. A good point there is combines. You know, it's kind of like they're big, complicated machines. They can just about run on their own, but when they break, you've got to take them into the shop, and it takes a human to fix them.
Absolutely. I grew up among combines. I know what you're talking about.
But, you know, I was at a space conference one year, and it was at NASA Ames, and it was a Berkeley, a Cal professor who was talking. And he was making the case that this idea that there's a human spaceflight program and a robotic spaceflight program is BS, because it's all human spaceflight, because the robots can't function without humans at every step of the stage.
Oh,
from being manufactured to programmed to being fixed to everything. And so the whole space program is a human-oriented space program, and there really isn't a human spaceflight program versus a robotic spaceflight program. Everything relies on humans.
I think that's absolutely true. That's what I was trying to get at earlier when I was talking about the scientists in their offices receiving data, seeing things that no one had seen before. It's the same kind of idea. They're part of the precursor process. The robots don't just collect this data and then look at it themselves. The humans interpret this data and use it to, among other things, determine interesting places for humans to go. Not so much at this point what I was talking about with hazards, but eventually we'll get to the point where we have to do that. You know, right now there's not a human Mars expedition on the horizon, so people are not tending to look at the data in those terms, but everything they're doing now is laying groundwork for eventual human missions to Mars and other places.
Marshall, anything else you want to chime in on?
Yes, I noticed your thing about the Flagstaff battle for dark skies.
Right.
And I bought a farm out in Grant County, Oklahoma, and it's kind of like there's only about 4,000 people in the whole county, and almost everybody lives in two towns.
Mm-hmm.
And here they are, oil field workers are out there setting up oil fields, you know, tanks and yards and so on like that, and they have these big, huge floodlights.
Right.
All over the place. There isn't anybody out there to see anything in the middle of the night to keep people who aren't stealing from you from showing up anyway.
Yeah, you just kind of make it easier for them to steal stuff, right?
Duh. And not only that, but even if they did, unless you've got cameras, you're not going to catch them.
Right.
And let's face it, with CCD cameras, turn off the lights. You can actually see them better with the lights off.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of counterintuitive use of artificial light. And people pay for it. They pay dearly in terms of electricity and lighting fixtures and all sorts of other things like that to do things that are kind of dumb.
I'll tell you why it's dumb. The electric companies are charging $7.50 a month for each one of those lights, and it only uses about a buck and a half worth of electricity.
There you go. Okay.
the electric companies make lots of money over these lights sitting out there. Of course, they want to light up the whole bloody county. Every section ought to have at least 10 lights because the utility companies would make lots of money. On the other hand, somebody that loves astronomy like me goes, well, wait a minute, I'm out here camping on my property and these oil field places are lit up like a used car lot.
Yeah, it's a very brute force approach. And it's been proven that it actually is improved security to have more directed, less glaring light. I know from experience out on the reservations, the Navajo schools tend to be lit up like anything, and there's deep shadows where all sorts of mayhem occurs. When I was out doing a star party at one place, begging them to turn the lights off so we could actually see something, they told me about a teacher who had left a lighted area and then fallen downstairs in a shadowed area because her eyes were not adjusted and the stairs were not lit. And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Counterintuitive things that if you're trying to make things secure, you want to light the places that need to be lit. You don't need to have glare everywhere that ruins your night vision.
Yeah, well, since I saw that in your write-up, I just had to poke up.
You know, Marshall, years ago I did a show with, who was the gentleman in Flagstaff,
David? Chris Luganbill, I suspect.
Yeah, Chris, and on his Dark Skies program. And then I had some architects calling in, and I did some other shows. And a lot of communities have passed, regulations or whatever they're called to require dark skies type of lighting. So
it
doesn't glare and it doesn't allow any light to go upward. And unfortunately, these fixtures are all at a premium in cost. I mean, if you really want to get them used, you ought to make them cheaper than the other kind of lighting. But if you've ever seen dark sky lighting, and Flagstaff, I think, is the leading community that has actually done it in the whole community, you ought to go there at night and see what a difference it makes. I remember Chris showing us pictures of a car area, where they have car lot one
right
after another at night before and then after.
Right.
And I mean, the difference is dramatic. And architects in San Francisco have a code for dark sky lighting and are being able to use it. And they tell me that it's all about not using glare, but forcing the light downward and having it stay downward rather than
where
coming back
up.
Yeah.
One thing about the flight
deck. Unfortunately, I'm 10 miles from the nearest city limits.
Well, you probably see the fallout from it.
Because
you're near Dallas, you can probably see the light pouring out of Dallas from 100 miles away.
Oh, yes. That's one reason I want to go back to the farm.
Well, I was going to say, you mentioned the car lots. One of the exceptions to the rule here in Flagstaff is that car lots are allowed to use normal lights because the sodium lights or the I'm probably mixing up my types of lights here, but the lights that create the sort of orangish light,
right?
It destroys color discrimination, and they want to show off their pretty cars. So they actually have in the current Flagstaff code a loophole that within a certain distance of the observatories, they're permitted to use these normal lights, whereas everyone else is supposed to use the orange lighting.
Yeah, but I think what happened is they can use the normal lighting, but the fixtures are redesigned to keep the light from going up in the air.
Exactly.
And that's why you see a difference.
Everything in Flagstaff points down.
Yeah. And in fact, I got an email from a company somebody sent me their video that they use online, and I forget who it was, but it's a computer-created and fed street lighting company that can program advertising on the little signs under the street light and make them look in any shape you want, from colonial to ultra-modern, and all of this kind of stuff. And part of their sales pitch, until you got to the very last screen of the presentation, was the fact that this reduces substantial amount of glare going up in the sky.
Right.
The last part of the slide said it's also wired into Homeland Security regional offices for easy following and tracking of problem developments.
Oh, okay.
So now we have a whole different genre of street lights that you might find in your neighborhood connected directly to Homeland Security. But the lighting was really cool. I have to say that. And for someone who's had a telescope in their backyard and can't see anything because of San Francisco Bay Area light pollution, it's really pathetic when you're in a light pollution area.
You had an earthquake up. Well, of course, you have lots of earthquakes, but I recall a story where the lighting downtown was off because of an earthquake, and the police were besieged with calls about a strange silver band across the sky. And people were asking, is that what caused the lights to go out? Is that what caused the earthquake? And after a while, somebody figured out they were talking about the Milky Way. The people didn't normally get to see it, so it seemed very mysterious to them.
Well, again, for people who live in cities and you've never been to the desert or, you know, out on the open ocean away from lighting of your boat and, you know, or mountains or someplace, and you've actually seen what a night sky is like, I feel sorry for you because it's nothing like what you have in a city.
Yeah, come to Flagstaff, everybody.
You know, or come to Flagstaff or go to the deserts in Tucson and get 20 miles away from the city or something. It is, the night sky is unbelievable.
Absolutely.
Marshall, what else?
Oh, I could go on with another little topic, but I think I ought to let you guys have more fun.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Marshall.
Thank you. Bye.
So Marshall has freed our toll-free line, 1-866-687-7223. What are some of the things you do at the USGS? And I know there's an observatory there in Flagstaff, not just the Lowell Observatory, right? Are you part of that?
Well, we've got a really interesting history as far as that goes. The USGS, well, the first folks to come here, of course, were Percival Lowell and his folks, looking mainly at Mars back in the 19th century. And then in the 1950s and early 60s, when the space race started up, other folks came here. After that, the Naval Observatory came out here. There's actually a Naval Observatory Flagstaff Station. It's the funniest thing because we got these big anchors up in front of the building, and here we are at 7,000 feet above sea level. But they've got an observatory there, and then USGS came here a little later than the others. But we started out by using the telescopes at Lowell Observatory because we were interested in doing lunar mapping. And at that time, we didn't yet have spacecraft going to the moon, or at least we had some that were trying but not yet getting there. And we established a 30-inch telescope out at a place called Anderson Mesa, which has since been handed off to Lowell Observatory. And we don't use that telescope anymore because, after all, we've got spacecraft data now. They've used that telescope in the recent past to look for asteroids that approach the Earth, and in other kinds of asteroids, too. What we do nowadays is primarily tied in with the spacecraft missions. We interpret data that comes back from those missions, and we also create mapping tools, digital elevation models that are used in site selection, things of that nature. Mapping tools are a big part of what we do nowadays. And many people who are interested in space, I suspect, know that Flagstaff and planetary and lunar mapping are pretty much synonymous. You'll find the name Flagstaff on all those USGS maps of the moon and planets that circulate out there. And we've been doing those since 1961. We've produced pretty close to 1,000 published maps so far in that period of time.
And that's the office that you're working in?
Yeah, that's the portion of the in part, well, USGS is part of Department of Interior, and Department of Interior, of course, you know, cabinet level. USGS is one small part of that, and then astrogeology is another small part of USGS. And the facility that I run is wholly NASA-funded, which is a little different than it's a little different than the rest of ASTRO, but we're part of ASTRO. We're not really quite part of the library system for USGS, but it's sort of similar arrangement. And basically, we're an archive. We've got imagery going back to the earliest space missions, mostly hard copy, but some of that, you know, is being replaced online, so we're actually getting rid of some of that stuff because we don't need it anymore. But also lots of documentation on mission planning. In particular, we've got a huge amount of material on Mariner 9, and which was the very first long-term planetary mission. It spent a whole year at Mars, or mapping the planet in detail for the first time. We've got a lot of documentation on the decisions that were made on how to run that mission, which is kind of, it's really fascinating, actually. We're getting ready to launch a new website. We've had a very, well, fairly crude website for the time since I started about 4 years ago, and we finally have the opportunity to upgrade it. And if all goes well, this Wednesday it'll go live. If you want to find it, just look for USGS Astrogeology. You'll do a Google search, and you should be able to get to it. My facility is called the Regional Planetary Information Facility. And as I said, it's kind of an archive of all sorts of information about planetary exploration over the last 50 years or so.
You have a note from Stephen, who's in Canada.
Okay. Hi, Stephen.
And his email is, the two most popular types of street lighting are sodium-based. The white lights are high-pressure sodium, and the orange color comes from the low-pressure sodium bulbs.
That sounds right.
So you got to have sodium lighting, I guess.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've looked at that, so I don't recall which is which or any of that stuff, but that sounds right. And the low-pressure sodium, people don't like it because it makes, how do they phrase it? It knocks out color rendition, which is not good if you're trying to sell colorful cars or if you've got a storefront that needs to be, you know, look like normal human sort of colors.
Good for Halloween, right?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Plants can look just about completely black sometimes, I've noticed, in the sodium vapor lighting. However, it does, it does cut down on the light pollution. And in a town like Flagstaff, where millions of dollars come into the economy from the observatories and science facilities, well, that's important.
Well, I know that the famous Southern California observatories have really been severely weakened, Mount Wilson and Palomar, because of all the lighting that has sprung up around it. And the same thing is true with Kitt Peak in Tucson.
Oh, absolutely.
They're picking up pollution from in and around Tucson and what's encroaching. You have another caller. Let's see who's on.
Okay.
Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Oh, this is John, Atlanta.
Yes.
Yeah, I was noticing a lot of his bio and all his motivations with science fiction and all. The 2001 A Space Odyssey and James Blish's Cities in Flight series.
Yeah, I don't know if those are motivations as much as entertainment.
Entertainment. I always found, in my younger days, the Cities in Flight thing, particularly the first book about the idea of the blanket relationship between gravity and magnetism. That was always the kind of was the thing that I was interested in physics. That was always something I was interested in, the concept of some kind of breakthrough in physics that we could really open up space travel in a way that, you know, nothing could really, you know, like we really don't have.
Replace rockets and make them seem really outmoded, kind of like the difference between steamships and sailing ships or something like that.
Something like that, yeah. That was one of the things I kind of noticed. But it seems like to me that over the years, it doesn't look to me like the progress in physics is likely to lead in that direction, though.
Oh, you know, I still have this faint glimmer of hope that, you know, Zefram Cochran's going to invent warp drive, you know?
Really, yeah.
I don't know if it's based on anything except just hope, but, you know, I just hope it does happen. It would be very exciting to, you know, open a wormhole or whatever, open a stargate. I don't know. We'll see, you know. I know folks in ancient Greece understood a lot of the physical principles that we do, but they never applied them in the way that we have. Maybe it's just a matter of looking at it in a new way, and someday somebody will do that.
Well, I keep waiting for 7 of 9 to establish a comm link so I can beam this space show to all over the galaxy. And
cause all over the blitz.
She's really good at establishing those comm links.
There
but,
you go.
talk about La La Land.
Well, I mean, it all gets down to the issue that gravity as we know it is coupled basically with a rather weak coupling constant to mass. I mean, To accomplish something like this would mean you have to create gravitational-like effects with something we can control that would be coupled in a much more strong fashion, it would seem like.
Yeah, I don't know. You're getting into an area that I, the lowly historian, don't know much about.
Yeah. That was pretty good. I also saw you like Doctor Who, but you like the new Doctor Who, I guess. Huh?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I've gotten interested in some of the old ones since I've been watching the new one, but I used to just hate the thing. Star Trek was always my thing, but the new Doctor Who is just too hilarious half the time to miss.
Well, the old ones had a very quirky English flavor to them.
Yeah,
maybe
that's
funny.
My problem.
I mean, they were never. I don't think that was ever really trying to be exactly serious science fiction. It was
right.
Kind of.
Well, anybody who travels through space in a 1960s police box. You know, they've got my vote. I think that's cool.
Well, I have an interesting viewpoint with 2001 and Doctor Who is that Doctor Who is a comical look at the people behind the slab.
Okay, there you go.
Hey, John,
what an awesome idea. In reality, you have great powers, but like,
what is light pollution like in Atlanta?
Light pollution in Atlanta?
Yeah. At night.
I really don't know. I suppose it's pretty bad.
Well, when you go out at night in Atlanta, can you see the sky at all, or is it totally bleached out?
I think you can see the sky, but I think stars and stuff. If I go for my walks, I think you can see probably pretty bad, though, by standards of astronomy, I would guess. If you're looking for faint stars or something, huh?
Or if you had a telescope in your backyard, would you be able to see much?
Yeah, I don't have, so I'm not sure.
I suspect you wouldn't be able to see too much. Having driven through Atlanta and some of those cities out in the southeast at night, they don't. Well, Phoenix even here and just down the road in Arizona, they don't tend to focus too much on the night sky. And the best you can see typically is a few planets, maybe the brightest stars.
Yeah, I don't think it's that. That's why I say you see a few things, but it probably isn't, you know, adequate for good astronomy.
Yeah, I lived in Houston for a number of years. I worked at Johnson Space Center, and everybody, you know, I was a member of the astronomy club, but their observatory was located about an hour and a half out of town in order to get away from the big light dome over the city.
Yeah. Well, that's a tough one, yeah. Well, another thought on this general thought, we were talking about humans and robotics and the progress level, I kind of think that these things come in cycles, and you know, like early science fiction, if you read the stuff before World War II, they always envisioned a lot of these things in mostly way in the future, you know, 500 years or something, you know.
Yeah.
And then, of course, after World War II, the V2, everything sped up, and now it's going to happen real quick. But maybe the early guys are kind of right in a way. There'll be this big lull for a century or two, and then something will motivate us to get back, the human race at least, country or organization would be doing it, but, you know, get back into it again in a very serious way. You know?
I think that's quite possible. You know, I really think you could argue that we got spoiled by the idea that, you know, we can get to the moon in 10 years. And maybe what we've seen since then is a more typical kind of pace for this kind of thing. I think back to the explorers who followed Columbus. It took over a century for the English to establish Jamestown. for example. It took a while for the whole idea that you could go to the New World and make money and live there to percolate out and get into our society. It took a while for the technology to catch up with the aspirations. And maybe that's where we're at right now. It's sort of an unfortunate thing for those who'd like to travel to other worlds, but you know, maybe they were born a century or so too soon.
Hey, John.
Yes?
You've offended our brethren on the other side of the ocean. So Anthony has says, enough of your porky comments toward Englishmen.
Oh.
So I don't know if you want to refight the Revolutionary War here and challenge him back.
What did I do wrong here, I wonder?
Well, I think you were disparaging to the British sci-fi people.
Oh, well, I just like the Doctor Who.
I think he's kidding, by the way, but I'm reading his email.
Well, it's a very quirky show. The early one particularly was very, very enjoyable, but... But anyhow, yeah.
Well, you better cut your losses short, John. Here before you read.
Well, really say something. Well, I mean, I've certainly watched a lot of it so over the years.
Well, I have a show coming up with the British Interplanetary Society, one of their leading historians, coming up. So
nice.
if you decide to call in on that one, John, you're going to have to polish your language. Okay.
British contributions. I mean, after all, I mean, Blackett, I mentioned in the earlier part, is definitely a British scientist, so.
There you go.
Yeah. At any rate, well, I'm going to let you go on to other topics then.
Okay, thanks, John. Oh, wait, before you leave, I forgot to make a very important announcement for the show tomorrow. It is in the newsletter, but the show is going to be an evening show, not an afternoon time, and Gary Hudson is the guest on rocket reusability and other things, and it's going to be a 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. show, California time. Adjust to your time zone. There is no show tomorrow afternoon. It's in the newsletter, but y'all haven't seen the newsletters yet. So just needed to get that announcement out there.
I'll have to try you on that one, and there's Mark Millis coming up the day after.
Yeah, but that's a typical Tuesday evening show. So.
Yeah.
So,
but it's sort of related to some of the topics we've sort of broached today.
Yeah, well, yes and no, but
sort of.
We'll see. All right, thanks, John.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. So here's another couple of emails. Actually, got three of them that have come in. So Ted in San Diego says, when David read your bio, he mentioned the educational work you've done with Navajo and Hopi reservations. I've been throughout their reservations and the different mesas in Arizona, and I understand that their mythology and legends are very steep in Star People. I'm wondering what your experience was with members coming in for these programs. Do they have a deep affinity and really like astronomy? Are they steeped in their own legends and mythologies about coming from Star People and space legends?
Well, that's a real interesting question. What I found, unfortunately, in working on the reservation was that the students generally didn't care that much about what we were doing. And I would do daytime stuff in the classroom where they were sort of held hostage. But when evening came, typically we didn't even get the people from the class coming in. We'd get people who happened to be wandering by the school, or maybe there'd be a ball game going on, and they'd come over from that. I didn't detect an overwhelming interest in the sky. One thing that was interesting that's related to what you're saying is that in some places, you'd go into one community, and they would say, oh, we can't look at the moon because the elders say that that's against the rules right now, and for various, I guess you could call them religious reasons. And then you'd go over to the next town over, and they'd say, oh, can't look at the moon, no problem. It's the right season for looking at the moon. And it just depended on which set of elders you talked to. They all had their own different interpretations of the astronomical aspects of their faith, their religion, I guess you'd say. Rather than mythology, I think religion is probably the more sensitive word to use, since these people are actually practicing their mythology, if you will. But in any case, not that that's a problem to call it that. But anyway, yeah, I didn't detect any real affinity. And as I said, it was really hard to get the schools to turn the lights down so that we could do star parties. Even though they invited us to come out to do the star parties, they couldn't understand why they should turn the lights off. So I don't know. I'm not sure how much the sky really matters.
Interesting. Here, our friend Stephen in Canada said, LED lights are starting to make inroads but are pretty expensive. Dark skies compliant versions exist but are usually double the cost or more standard versions of street lighting. Many of the heads which house the LED bulbs can be retrofitted to most standard poles. Another popular light is the mercury vapor light, but environmental concerns have been restricting its use over the years. The mercury hisses. I have them on my street, and they hiss, especially when it's cold.
Interesting. Okay.
Okay, so here's another one from I read Anthony's comments to you. So it's interesting that from your, I guess I would call it a limited experience, you can correct me if that's wrong, but in working with the Navajos and the Hopis, their interest in their own, we're from space people or star people or space legends, aren't there with the modern kids. I guess it's a lot like with us, how you know, everybody's caught up in technology and the gadgets and the new world, and what happened in the past is being dropped by the wayside.
I'm not really sure if I can fully understand it. I worked out there for 5 years, and you know, all through the school year, and then occasionally during, we do summer things with community organizations. There's a town called Tuba City.
Yeah, I've been to Tuba City.
Yeah, their hospital actually put on a program where I came out and did star parties, which was kind of interesting. I don't really know what to you know, how to explain it. The students, well, how do I say this? The students didn't seem to care that much about their own education, and maybe that's just normal for high school kids. I don't know. The interest in education was fairly limited. So I don't know where to, you know, explain that. The star people idea, I think that's probably more the Hopi than the Navajo. The Navajo think they came out of a hole in the ground somewhere out there on the reservation, as I understand it. They were kind of born out of the earth. And it's something that they like to talk about a lot. So maybe the Hopi or the star people folks, or maybe in other Native American groups. I'm not as familiar with the Hopi as I am with the Navajo.
Well, all of that is, you know, when I was doing the Dude Ranch stuff with my kids in Tucson, they had a Cherokee medicine man there who talked about Cherokee star people.
Okay.
Legends, which are really steeped. And actually, there's a fabulous book, if you're really interested in this, called the, damn it, I can't believe I'm not going to remember it. It's really a great book, the Something of Little, maybe I can find it real quick. It's one of my favorite ever books that I read to my kids, and then they read it when they got older on their own.
Would that be The Education of Little Tree?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
That, where he grew up in an orphanage, and then what a fabulous book. I don't know. Did you like that book, too?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I think it helped me to understand some of the students I was working with out on the reservation. You know, in some cases, I would come out, there was a kind of a sense of resentment that I was even there. And I could kind of understand that. I could see where they were coming from based on experiences of people like in Education of Little Tree.
Now, people, if you have never read that book, if you have small kids or kids in school, I would really recommend that you give them that book to read. And I promise you, nine out of ten of them will really like that book. Probably easy to get on Amazon, I would imagine.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Probably on a Kindle, too.
Yeah, or the library. Don't forget libraries.
Or don't forget libraries. Yeah, I never think in terms of libraries, but you're absolutely right. It's probably in most decent libraries. So in terms of your work for USGS, do you do anything like with the GPS system and are you using it for mapping accuracy or anything like that?
I don't do that really myself, although I've started doing some training on that so that I can point people the right direction when they, come to me, because I'm kind of the outreach person. Outreach stuff comes to me first. However, the other folks in our organization, that's a big part of what they do. Of course, when they're mapping other planets, GPS is only so effective. But they also do Earth analog studies, and GPS is very important for that. We've got people here who are studying dunes, for example, but mostly on Mars, but they're also looking at dunes on the Earth, and also on Titan, dunes on Titan. They're looking at dunes on the Earth to be able to better understand the dunes on those other worlds. So when they do that kind of thing, Earth analog work, then they're doing GPS. But GIS, we've got a lot of people working with that.
Say that again. What is it? G what?
Oh, what does it stand for? GIS. But it's ways of handling geographic data, and you can input planetary data into that and use the GIS system to do planetary mapping. It's really interesting. We've got some of the world leaders in the use of GIS in planetary mapping right here in Flagstaff.
Here's another. This is interesting. Paul in Los Angeles. Do most of the people working in your division at USGS, are they space cadets, or is it just another job?
Well, that's a really good question, and it applies to a lot of space places I've worked. I mean, Johnson Space Center and other places, too. Lowell Observatory. It's a mix. There's some really heavy-duty space cadets. There's one fellow whose office is all decked out with starships and spaceships and you name it. And then there's others who their offices are decked out with, fish that they like to catch, that kind of thing. So it's a real mix. Some people have come to it because of their geographical or their, that's not really the right word I'm looking for, but cartographical. Their cartographic training. Other people have come to it because they've been fascinated by space all their lives. And this is sort of the culmination for them to have a job where they're working with planetary data to do mapping and also to understand, what we're seeing on those worlds. It's a mix. I mean, just like any kind of job, I suppose you have people who are real fascinated by it and other people who just are doing it because it's a job. But maybe half and half. I'll say that.
listeners, there's still time if you would like to call us, although we are approaching the end of our typical show. Again, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. The Skype ID is one word, The Space Show. And so if you do have a question, there isn't any time left for you to put it off. You need to give us a call on one of those two sources, or you can still email us at drspace@thespaceshow.com.
Dave, can I mention one thing?
Yeah, of course.
I'm going to make a plug here for that new website. One of the things that we've got up there are three movies, and they're all relatively brief. They all date from the 60s. One is, and we were talking about the Hopi earlier, one is a jetpack demonstration among the Hopi Buttes back in the 1960s. It was very interesting. The idea was they were going to use these on the moon potentially, but of course we never did. The other one is where we created a one-to-one scale model of the section of the Sea of Tranquility by blowing craters in a cinder field out here. And we've got the footage for how they set up the explosives and then set them off to create the craters. The other one is a kind of a tour of a lunar Apollo lunar roving vehicle mock-up that we created for training for astronauts. And it's really fascinating because it follows basically the same engineering layout as the LRV, but it's designed for operation on Earth. So those are going to be kind of cool movies for people to see, I suspect.
Okay, and for those that have gone to the website, is it the same URL that there is now, or will it be a different URL for the new website?
Well, that's why I said they should probably search on usgs.astro, because I've only been seeing the internal URL so far, and for whatever reason, they haven't shared with me, at least, the final URL for that. If they go to the Astro website, with the new layout that they've got, it's very intuitive and very easy to find things. So they should be able to find my facility pretty quickly.
Okay, and listeners, in the archives, David has sort of a bio, his own website on astrogeology. I will give you that URL now. I'll also put it in the archives. It's http://astrogeology, one word, .usgs.gov. But then if you want to go on to his website, go to /about/people/his name, David Portree, P-O-R-T-R-E-E, one word. Both names are put together, no space, no dots,
right.
And you'll get to his site. But possibly if you just stop at gov, you'll get to the astrogeology site. Now, when you go to his site, you have all these links above for space, for mapping, for this, for that. And I'm assuming that's not your stuff. That's the astrogeology USGS stuff.
Right. That's the astrogeology stuff. And then all that's going to be changing this Wednesday, actually, assuming everything comes off as planned.
Have you seen the new website? Have you seen the...
Yeah, it's nice.
Okay.
It's got a lot of active things like slideshows and plenty of ways for us to add material. I've already added something, and they haven't even launched it yet. I've added an Excel spreadsheet with all of our maps since 1961 to it. Eventually, we're going to have something searchable with thumbnails, but for now, the Excel spreadsheet will have to do.
And it's available to anyone who goes there.
Yeah, and people can go to that spreadsheet. They can find maps they're interested in and contact me through a link, and I can send them to them. And we don't charge for those maps. If you go to Denver to USGS, they charge for them. We, as part of our responsibility to the science community, are supposed to make these available. So if you contact me, I can send you maps.
Al, this is interesting. David, we're both David, so I don't know which one he's talking to. But he says, I'm a U of A student. Well, and I know, David, you were too. I guess he's talking to me. And I know there are skiing possibilities in the Flagstaff area. If I go up there to go skiing, does his office or his department have tours?
We do, actually. People need to contact me directly, and they'll be able to do that via the website or via the phone book. If they just call Astro, it'll be routed to me. We do tours. I need a little bit of advance warning so people can, you know, so I can fit it in with other tours in my own schedule. And they can take all sorts of different forms. They can last half an hour. They can last a couple hours, depending on what a person wants to do and whether he has a group with him, that sort of thing.
Can they get there in the winter? Flagstaff's not snowed under, is it?
No, right now it's raining. It's actually quite warm today.
No, but I mean in the middle of the winter, you're at 7,000 feet.
We're already in the middle of the winter.
Well, it's not like Grand Forks where I teach in North Dakota where there's 20 feet of snow piled by the roads.
It can be like that.
It can.
Yeah, but see, we're also at 35 degrees north latitude, which means the sun is pretty fierce. And so the snow doesn't hang around too much.
Beautiful country, listeners. If you've not been to Flagstaff, you should do it. And there is a really interesting space crowd at Northern Arizona State, especially in their anthropology department. I don't know if you've ever connected with that or not.
I've mostly been involved with the astronomy and physics people. And in fact, we've had space grant students working all over our facility, NASA space grant students.
Uh-huh.
And I've had them working for me in my facility. So, yeah, we do have university connections.
What should I have asked you that I've omitted or forgot, or what else would you like to talk about today?
Well, gosh, you caught me off guard here. I think we've covered a lot of good territory, and it's been really interesting hearing from folks. I suppose the only thing I'd say is that I hope people will go over and have a look at the blog, and if they have any inputs they'd like to make, I'd love to hear them. And I'm always on the lookout for documents that pertain to space history. Sometimes I get interesting stuff from people who are retired from industry, that sort of thing. So if anybody wants to share stuff with me, I'd be more than happy to hear from them.
What, do you give out your email address, or you want me to filter for you if listeners want to get a hold of you?
If they go to the blog, they can connect up with me pretty quickly.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's what I would encourage folks to do. That way they'll also have a better sense of what I'm talking about.
Okay. I think this is the first of many shows we'll do together. This has been a lot of fun, very informative.
Oh, great.
And I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it too.
And Chris is still around there. As I told you in an email, I'd like to do an update on Dark Skies. So he's still there, right?
Oh, he is. Yeah, he works over at the Naval Observatory.
Right,
that's
I remember.
That's his main thing.
And he's still interested in the topic?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay. I will send him a note and see if I can't do an updated program with him. And you and I will talk, and the next time I'm in the Flagstaff area, we got to get together. I'd look forward to meeting you. But this has been an absolute delight talking to you, and I've learned a lot of new things about what our government is doing and what goes on in your area and some of the projects you're interested in.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. And listeners, remember, Gary Hudson tomorrow is our guest, 7 p.m. There is no afternoon show tomorrow. So special thanks to fellow David. Boy, there have been a lot of Davids on the show lately. And look for the newsletters, and off we go into next week, another week on The Space Show. Goodbye from David Portree and myself and The Space Show. Everybody have a great, safe, and really good week. Goodbye.